So I think we are 3 days now into our full schedule and 5 days into the winter retreat. And for those of us participating and living here, there's a, at least for myself, I can say there's, you know, a very felt difference in the experience. You know, from the usual schedule we have with our chores and work periods, and at least for the monastics, that's very much slowed down quite a bit. And we have a schedule of sitting and walking and yoga and readings. So the sense, you know, one can have is all of a sudden that there can be some difficulty involved. You know, like the mind is being, there's a lot more time to pay attention to the mind, and we don't have guests coming and going here. So even the retreat support team is having a lot more quiet of an experience, and they're being restrained in their speech. The monastics are being restrained in theirs. There's a sense of group intention that has filled the air. And so we're all benefiting from that very much. And what arises for me is just starting to see the habits and patterns. I think just today or yesterday, Ajahn Yanako asked me to give the Dhamma talk, and my response wasn't one of keen interest. And I reflected on that, and it was coming from a, oh, not yet, or not now, or I have, you know, I'm just putting down my responsibilities, I'm not ready. And that's, you know, that can be a lot of how we hold things, and it can be a bit dangerous. So this is called, you know, compartmentalization. We think it's, now's not the time for me to do this, or I'm only ready for this at that time. And we can do that with our own sense of practicing mindfulness. Like, I have my chore to do. I don't have time for mindfulness right now. I'll hurry up and do it as quickly as possible, and then I can practice, you know, or the kitchen chores or whatever it might be. We always have this opportunity to practice. It's not really fair or helpful for us to say that there's time when we're not doing so, or we're not having the opportunity, we can't do it in a particular situation. So we have, I think it's very helpful to be aware of that tendency, not now. And as you've probably heard many times, the time is always now. And so when we begin working with our minds, we see this as some of the habits that we have, the difficulties that we have, and what can come up for us a lot is what the Buddha called the nivarana. These are the hindrances, and he put them in a category of five, and most of us are well aware of these, mostly because we're very susceptible to them, and they're quite common in our experience. So the first is like sensual desire, kamachanda, and the second is, we can say, is aversion or ill will, which is translated from biapada. And after that is sloth and torpor, which in Pali is tinamita. And I think a lot of people's favorite pronunciation for the fourth one is restlessness and regret, or restlessness, worry and regret. And that word actually is it's a bit onomatopoeic. It sounds a little bit like the word. It's udacha kukucha. So you might feel some udacha kukucha. And then the last one is skeptical doubt. We can get caught in doubt. doubt circles. That's wichikicca. And so we might recognize these and what's coming up for us. We might see them very clearly. And I remember a funny question that I heard from someone who had practiced quite a while, but maybe hadn't gone in depth or tried to understand this point. But the question was, are these hindrances still operating when we're not meditating? And the obvious answer is yes, of course. You know, and if we don't know that, we're just not seeing them. So they're called hindrances because they hinder us, they pull us back, they don't allow us to experience peace and calm. And it's like we get snagged on them, and they can take over our whole world. And then we have a hard time putting them down. We have a hard time seeing clearly through them. The Buddha, in the metaphors of these five hindrances, uses like a bowl of water or a pot of water. And sometimes it's like filled with different colors to emphasize one, and another might be, you know, like with ill will, like boiling, where you can't see. In all of them, you just can't see clearly through them. You know, or there's muck and green things growing, and we can't get through it. So these are really things that hold us back from our own experience of peace and happiness. And so as we're getting our minds are quieting down, we will become aware of which one of these might be prominent for us in any given meditation, or possibly all five will come up. And they have many different flavors. So one that is, I think, why it's the first is it's just so typical. It's just sensual desire. You know, the sense of what kind of pleasure can I gain from any sense that's coming up? And the mind is one of those senses. So there's actually six senses. And so we can just be thinking about something and gaining pleasure from it, thinking about something we're going to have or we want to have, or something in our past that we had that's pleasant. And this can just kind of overwhelm our mind. So possibly the entire time we're meditating, we're just thinking about getting this, getting that. And it's very hard sometimes to see through it. So the working in the kitchen, this can kind of come up. What kind of things we're going to prepare, might get excited about making something, or this morning we had a special breakfast, and that was offered in Peter's honor as we chanted this evening as well. So what did that bring up? As soon as I walked into the room, I saw that, and I said, oh, you know, it wasn't, what's wrong here? Why is this happening? It's like, oh, pleasant taste. Oh, what can I get here? Can I get my, what I want? And so that's just something to be aware of. It's not something we need to judge ourselves for, but it's, oh, okay, like, well, what do I do in this situation? And we could scowl and say, I'm not going to eat any of it. Or we could say, okay, I'm going to try to restrain myself. I'll have just some, or I won't. I'll watch this sense of desire, and I'll try to really work with that, not just continue to give in to whatever it is I want. And so we keep having an opportunity to work with these, and then we see what the result is when we are able to put down that sensual desire. So the Buddha encourages us to practice sense restraint, And it's interesting because sense restraint, at least how the Buddha describes it, is not to close our eyes, you know, put our hands over our ears. It's to really examine like how it is that we take up an object of desire and how we can see that object in a very different way. One of the translations by Bhikkhu Bodhi, I think, is called not taking or getting absorbed in the signs and features. So it's like if we think of that it's the two words are a bit different, but it's like the whole and the parts, and you know the sort of the sign of something that we appreciate or the features of that thing, and we try to see that clearly. So it might be, oh, that person has such beautiful eyes, you know, and so instead of getting absorbed in that, we might actually think about their eyes and our hands, you know, and how maybe unattractive that would be, or slimy at least, and although perhaps fascinating, but we wouldn't have that attraction anymore, you know, and hopefully, I don't know, maybe it's possible, but there's ways we can counteract something, you know, or trying to see like if we particularly like some food, we can see like what is that, you know, which part of the food do I like, you know, all the things on a pizza, you know, which one is it? Well, it's kind of everything. I'm taking up the whole sign of that object of desire, and I'm not seeing its parts, so I'm not taking it apart. I'm also not seeing the clearly what's gone into it, all the work, the labor to get those things, the pain, the difficulty, the trucks that needed to be washed in order to transport them here, and the all of the things involved. We dismiss all of those things and we get absorbed in them, in the objects of our desire. And so when we have a sense of restraint, then we're actually taking these things up in our mind. We're making an effort to not see things the way that our sensual desires is steering us towards. So we can say that's called yoniso manasikara, or wise attention. And yoniso manasikara comes from yoniso, I believe, is like a root word for womb, like the beginning of things, and manasikara is attention. So when you think about that, it's like the womb of attention, or the beginnings of something, how we perceive something and look at something from the beginning, from the start. And if we have ayoniso manasikara, then we're seeing with unwise attention, and we're looking at things just like that. Like, I just want this, I want that, and we're just getting completely caught up in these desires. So you can see that in your meditation when you're meditating, because it's very blinding. And it just comes from not paying attention to the way things would be to as an antidote to that. So for sensual desire, it's often like seeing something that's unbeautiful, seeing something that isn't attractive in the thing that we're seeing that's attractive. And that's a lot of work. And for some people, it might be disappointing. I just want to follow my breath and not have to think about this stuff. But if you're caught in sensual desire, you might not be able to follow your breath. You might not be able to create peace for yourself because there's so much agitation. So these are things we're being careful of, and we also want to really see like what is stimulating us. What are the things that we tend to go to? What are those things that, for us, bring up this fever, sensual fever, and what are the ways that we can learn? Like, well, how do I put that down? And that's what the Buddha is teaching in what's called right effort. You know the arising of something that's unwholesome, that's not beneficial for you, and you know how to create its demise in a way. You know how to reduce it. And then you also know how to prevent it from arising in the future. So this is an effort we're making. This isn't just kind of ignoring things and just following our breath. We're using our own body to observe our experience. But then as these experiences are coming up, we're using and analyzing, understanding what we need to do if we're overwhelmed by any particular hindrance. One that is that's pretty easy to get into is like just that sense of aversion. I think one time Ajahn Jayasaro was here and he was talking about just like a baby, what are a baby's first words after mother, father, whatever, but eventually, pretty quickly, it learns to say, and I hope Ajahn Yanako corrects me, or actually Ajahn Guy, surrounded by Thai speakers here, my now is I don't like, I don't want. But that sense of a child saying that, I don't want it, I don't like it, get it away from me. It's one of the earliest things, or I do like it, as I was talking about the first, the first quality, the first hindrance. I don't want this. And how often each day, you know, can you count the times that comes up? I don't like it, I don't want it to be this way. You know, why is the schedule this way? Why is this person that way? Why is the food this way? You know, the chanting. Whatever it is, we can have this sense, this biyapada, that sense of like I don't like this, I don't want it, and then that can go even further, unfortunately, into like wishing harm, like ill will. And so this can come up in any number of ways. I remember Ajahn Amaro was explaining to some of the retreat support team that, you know, at one time, I think it was Amravati or Chitters, I can't remember, but there was a time in the kitchen where people were working quietly, and then all of a sudden, I think the head cook had walked up to somebody who was cutting some carrots, and the next moment, the knife was pointing to the head cook's throat, and the person who was cutting carrots said, "Don't tell me how to cut those carrots." And you never know. I mean, it can come to blow, just like the shape of a carrot. And this can just arise in us and come out, and we're just completely caught off guard. That's where the Buddha was describing this as like boiling water. So we're trying to see that before it's arising and prevent it, and also just get very used to that habit when it arises. And one of the things that comes up for us is we might think, like with sensual desire, okay, I'm going to practice some asubha. I'll focus on one of the practices the Buddha recommends is if we have a lot of desire or we're very distracted and we're just thinking life's going to go on forever, you think about death, the body, what makes up the body, what is the body like when it dies, what are the stages of decay that occur, or just thinking about the body, the internal organs. And this might sound morose or not, you know, maybe people who want to see their body as a temple, it's something, you know, against that, but actually it's a reality. You know, if we open ourselves up, it doesn't smell too good. It's kind of sticky and wet, and it's just not very attractive. And somebody might still, again, have some sort of fascination with parts of the body, but I don't think that would last too long. You know, eventually it would, okay, I don't really want to hold these intestines in my hand anymore. So we think about that and we say, oh, that sensual desire can decrease really quickly. And with, you know, with something like ill will, you know, where the Buddha consistently recommends metta, wishing well for another person. And he also recommends the other brahmaviharas, so that of compassion and gladness for another's, receiving something good in their life, or just developing equanimity. But with metta, you know, he says this is the way that we can counteract that feeling of hate or I don't like, I don't want, especially when it's regarding another person. But it's not easy, is it? Because, you know, we might you might notice that aversion, and then it's like, oh, right, I forgot, right? May I be well, may I be happy, you know, may everyone be well, may all beings be happy, except the head cook. And then we're caught again, and we see like, okay, this is something that's to be worked on. So it's not just like pulling out our asubha gun or our kind of metta gun and shooting these hindrances when they come up. This is something that we will see and recognize within our own habits and behaviors. Okay, what is consistently occurring for me here? And this can change by week, by day, by month. These different hindrances can take hold. And so we're learning like what it is that we use as antidotes, what's helpful for us. And this is an experiment. It's, again, like if we're having success with the Satipatthana and following, for example, the first tetrad, where we're having an easy time observing our body and then in that way observing our mind states, then that's wonderful and that's good. But the more subtle we go, we will possibly see these hindrances. And in order to really experience true peace, they need to be diminished. And eventually, you know, they need to become so subtle that they're just not a problem for us anymore. Or possibly just completely in abeyance. And of course, this is temporary until one has reached any stage of enlightenment. They're just going to be major problems, all the way up until arahantship or non-return or these very high attainments. So we want to get used to them. We want to know them, and we want to develop a skill set of how to deal with them. And so something like sloth and torpor. This is one of the very difficult aspects of meditation. If every time you sit down you're falling asleep, this is very painful for people. It can really rob one of any kind of sense of clarity. The other aspect of it is just kind of laziness. We call this like sloth, the sense of I'd rather not, or I don't want to do this, and we're not really making an effort. So there's an encouragement that developing peace and equanimity are not the greatest things to do when this hindrance comes up, because it's very hard to actually develop those when one's falling asleep. And so energy, you know, we want to figure out how can we generate energy for ourselves. One monk recently told me in Thailand that he just said, don't sit. Just walk. Just walk, walk, walk all day long. Hour after hour, and stabilize mindfulness in that way so that you build a very strong sense of confidence around your own experience of mindfulness, so that when you do sit maybe 5 or 10 years later, whenever it is, then that has a very strong power to it, and this hindrance no longer is a problem. One is no longer snagged by it. It doesn't cause a problem anymore. And, another antidote to that is just standing up. And even if one's in the hall here, you can go to the back of the room or somewhere and just do standing meditation. These are very wakeful poses. Or you can look up some of the other antidotes that the Buddha talks about, because there are things he really suggests to wake oneself up. Anywhere from, you know, trying to remember suttas, or splashing water in your face, looking at the stars. Another one that makes a lot of sense to me is just perceiving light. So you just like create the sun for yourself in your own mind's eye. And you try to perceive this as much as you can. Just light as much as you can. So there's ways, and the problem with this is that we can just get stuck in falling asleep. You know, it's just so pleasant eventually. People can find that you just sit down for a while and then you just fall into this kind of very closed state. And then there's nothing there. The bell rings and it's time to get up. So we want to be very careful with that dullness that might occur, and that takes us stepping up into rousing ourselves with energy. So what, you know, asking yourself right now as I'm talking, like what hindrance are you experiencing right now? Are you completely free of them? And as the, you know, what I said earlier, it's, you know, these are not just coming up when we're meditating. They're part of our experience. It might just be I'm uncomfortable now, or I want to go to sleep, or whatever it might be. We want to try to recognize that and then skillfully learn these antidotes for ourselves, and really try to understand them so they're very clear for us. And it's like being a very skilled carpenter or something. You know, you see some sort of plan, and then you know how to handle that. You know what you're doing. You know, so in a meditation, it would be really kind of looking at what's the hindrance right now. What's coming up, you know, and then as you're not in a like sitting or whatever you're doing, that maybe in between going for you know, some walking meditation or sitting, then what's coming up for you? It's not, again, just like that formal side. It's like it's a question. It's kind of a reflection. What's happening right now? Because then we don't have to be caught off guard. Somebody says something to us and we know we're experiencing aversion, and rather than snapping back, we just know, okay, this is not the time to speak. So, you know, continuing on, the, you know, this sense of laziness that can occur, it's very common. So we can also do this with distraction, just kind of distracting ourselves, and that's, you know, it's very easy to do that. And I think many of us are susceptible to this kind of thing where we're just like, I'd rather not, I don't want to bother, this is too much work. And then we don't put up much of a fight. We don't put a lot of energy into that. And we succumb to Mara, as it said, you know, Mara who's covering over our eyes. And that's where this hindrance of sort of slothfulness. This is where, in the eight precepts, we talk about having not sleeping on higher luxurious beds. This is a sense of really devoting ourselves to wakefulness. That's what that is really about, rather than just kind of the comfort of just sort of lying down. The Buddha talks about lazy stretching. You should avoid lazy stretching. This would not be. I'm not talking about yoga here. This is kind of like that kind of in your bed, and you're kind of barely stretching, moving around a little bit, and 30 minutes passes and you haven't gotten up. So we want to kind of push ourselves a bit, but this isn't with a voice of anger or that ill will or aversion. This is just an encouragement. Come on, get up, let's do this. You know, get into the hall. Try to be mindful. Try to encourage this. And it can be hard because sometimes we can feel beaten up. I mean, we're trying to take on this endeavor, and it's a bit rough sometimes because we're trying, and it just doesn't seem to be working. Some of the time, as I used the metaphors before, it's just like hitting your head against a wall, or sometimes feeling like you're in a room with all the lights out and you can't see anything and you're looking for a door and you just, it's hours, you can't find it. So we're really trying to still encourage ourselves, okay, you know, this is difficult sometimes, this isn't easy. And it's not a personal problem, it's just how practice goes. I haven't yet met someone who's told me they've had an easy time with understanding the Dhamma. The next hindrance is restlessness and remorse, and that's a favorite of mine. And it's quite an unpleasant thing. As I said, we want to be careful with that because we don't want to. That's not the time to be practicing rousing our energy. You know, so we're already aroused, and there's just too much. There's too much energy in the system. And so we need to really create peace for ourselves and try to understand that restlessness, trying to understand, you know, how we're helping to create it. And again, it's stopping us from clarity. It's kind of this sense of like, oh, and then there's this, and then I have to do that, and then I'm not sure what's going to happen next, and I should probably get this done and that done, and on the mind goes. These are the stories that we're creating for ourselves. And when it comes to remorse, you know, that's just, that can really, really rob the mind of any kind of peace. So we can get really just stuck in these circles. I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. You know, that thing that I said in high school was really horrible. And, you know, I really regret having it's like 30 years later, but we want to let go of these things. We can be filled with regrets. And one of the things that's important to try to remember is that, you know, in a certain way, we can't rewrite our own history. We can't change the things that we've done, but we can try to see it in a different light, you know? So I think a good example is, I recently had this situation with this cat that many of you know. So this cat came to the monastery, and the owner who brought it here was bringing it back to the monastery after it had been given away to the owner, and it ended up unfortunately getting lost, and it hasn't been found. And I could see the suffering in that I had created for myself because I had hopes. You know, I had hoped everything would work out. And so there was a regret around, that kind of sense of being involved and being hopeful because I had spent a month trapping that cat. And then it ended up coming back here. And now it's gone. And so that you know, that kind of the restlessness of mind, and then of course the aversion came up, and anger, and all of these things are stirring the mind. But it's about that, you know, that very attachment to a situation, that sense of it shouldn't be this way, or I wanted it to be that way, and on the hindrances can just be overwhelming to us, where we can't get out of them, we can't see them clearly. And in a way, I think it's interesting as a larger tale, like, well, what could I have done? I could have, can we do certain things in our life that we won't necessarily feel regret over them, even while we're doing them? You know, getting involved in helping another being, but then allowing equanimity to drive us so that we're not attached to how things are going to be. Because otherwise we get caught in these hindrances around these experiences we have in life, and around we go. And we don't see that, like, oh, what could I have done to have prevented that? You know, this is, again, part of that sense of right effort. And that sense of restlessness or remorse comes around because the mind is just chasing and chasing. It's just like a not going anywhere. It's just constantly on the move, but there's nothing in terms of real wholesomeness that it's moving towards. And so we want to try to create peace for ourselves. And one of the ways in terms of regret that the Buddha talks about is just to really look at our actions. So in that situation, I can see, oh, okay, well, actually, I did something really good. You know, I was trying to look after another being, and that's not something to regret. You know, perhaps I can try to temper the attachment around outcomes, but looking after another being is not something anyone should have a regret over. And so we try to handle our regret. We try to look at all of good things that we've done rather than focus on the negative things. And we try to see that, yes, we are the owners of our actions, and so are other people who are involved. They are also the owner of their actions. So we try to see that very clearly and understand that, so we're not you know, overwhelmed by this kind of cycling through the mind. And speaking of that same kind of ongoing nature is this vicikicca, this skeptical doubt. And this is the sense of, like, am I doing this right? What should I be doing? And, you know, maybe I shouldn't even be involved in this. And I'm not getting anywhere in my meditation. And maybe I should try metta. And then, no, actually, metta's not good. I should do that, the subha thing. And then maybe the breath is better right now. I'll just start with the breath. And it's just on and on. And we don't know if we're doing it right. And then we think about our future and our past. And it just goes on, and there's no end to this, because with doubt, when we ask ourselves these questions, it doesn't go away. It just continues to cycle around and around, and it doesn't end, because we can't end our doubts by trying to answer our questions. So we believe we can, we think we can, and that's the hindrance, that's the snag, that's where we get caught up. And so instead, we're really trying to work with recognizing our doubt and questioning ourselves. You know, where is this going to lead if I keep asking these questions? Where is it going? And so we can recognize the energy of doubt. You know, we can see the energetic feel within the body, and we can ask ourselves if that's a wholesome feeling. Is that something that's going to bring me to more wholesome states? And as a hindrance, we can hopefully see that no, it's not. So, you know, with all of these hindrances, we have ways that we can work with them. But this isn't like a small thing in our practice. It can take up enormous amounts of learning how to work with these, and in a way, this is a battle. You know, we are on the front lines, and we're constantly seeing. You know, in a way, are we winning or losing? Are we seeing that wholesome states are arising? Are we seeing that there is more peace, more clarity, more understanding? Are we gaining in right view, you know, understanding these Four Noble Truths? Or are we, you know, kind of confused or stuck in our stories and we can't get out? And so it's not a measure for us to evaluate whether we're good or bad. It's just a measure for us to evaluate where we are with our experience and our practice. And then from that, we move into, okay, well, what can I do here? You know, how can I figure this out? How can I wrestle with this? You know, it's like two people wrestling with each other. They're trying to understand how to outdo the other opponent, but that has to take in what's actually happening, the particular feel or mood of that moment with that other partner. So that's a sense of, oh, this it's like this right now. It's like that. That's not going to work in this particular case. I can't do that now. I have to try something different. And so if we ignore this and we just try to sort of focus on a meditation object, you know, we're just putting all our effort, we can burn ourselves out pretty quickly. We think, I'm just supposed to be focusing on the breath, and then we have all this stuff coming up, and we just push on the breath, and we don't see that there are other ways, other areas that we can use to try to really understand what our experiences and how to get ourselves out of trouble. And again, that's also how to prevent ourselves from getting into trouble. So this is a skill that takes time. And it's something that we have a great opportunity to practice on this retreat. It's something that we can really try to sink our teeth into and get to know. So rather than seeing the hindrances as like a negative thing, we can see them as really a challenge that we can overcome. You know, we're going to learn how to deal with them. In a way, it's like not going to a chess game and just saying, I really hate chess and I don't want to be here. It's like, well, this is what we're doing. This is what the Buddha's instruction is to us, that we have to face these hindrances. We have to face our opponent, but we're not doing so with hatred. We're doing so with a keen interest. You know, how can I learn how to deal with these so I can gain peace and clarity? I can gain understanding. And so it's important over time, over the time of the retreat, to really work with these elements and try to see, like, well, where have I sort of made some gains, and where have I had some clear understanding? Where did I learn something about this? And so it's also good to review when something worked, and to remember that, and like kind of keep that in your tool belt. So these are just some words of reflection tonight, and I hope that people are enjoying this quiet. I have a lot of gratitude for this winter retreat, and also especially for the support team that's here and looking after us. So it's very kind. That's one easy way to deal with any kind of or some of these hindrances, is just that sense of gratitude. So yeah, I just want to encourage everyone in their practice and keep going.